From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
I'm calling on him to charge the arresting officer in this case. We cannot turn a blind eye. It is on us as leaders to see this for what it is and call it what it is. George Floyd deserves justice.
Minneapolis is on fire as people again take to the streets to protest the murder of George Floyd, a black man killed by white police officer Derek Chauvin Monday. Video shows Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck as he repeatedly says, "I can't breathe." The Minneapolis mayor is calling for prosecutors to file criminal charges. We'll go to Minneapolis to speak with civil rights attorney and founder of the Racial Justice Network, Nakima Levy-Stromstrong. Then Larry Kramer, the legendary writer, trailblazing activist in the fight against AIDS, has died at the age of 84.
I'm approaching my end. But I still have a few years of fight left in me to scream out.
Yes. We love you.
To scream out the fact that almost everyone gay I've known has been affected by this plague of AIDS.
Larry Kramer helped start Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP to demand life-saving drugs. He faced off with Dr. Anthony Fauci before the two became friends. Many credit Kramer with saving thousands of lives. We'll host a roundtable with two ACT UP members, Gay USA co-host Ann Northrup and Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves. We'll also speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tony Kushner, who wrote Angels in America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from COVID-19 in the United States has passed 100,000, just 3 months after the U.S. recorded its first deaths from the novel coronavirus that emerged in China late last year. With just over 4% of the world's population, the United States has recorded roughly one-third of all coronavirus cases, averaging over 1,100 deaths per day since March. As bad as that figure is, a New York Times review of excess deaths suggests the true U.S. death toll is likely over 125,000. Throughout the month of February, as the coronavirus spread largely undetected through the United States, President Trump repeatedly downplayed the threat of the virus and claimed it was going to go away.
We have done an incredible job. We're going to continue. It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle.
On Wednesday, President Trump flew to Florida to watch NASA's planned launch of a new SpaceX spacecraft. The launch was aborted due to bad weather. Throughout the day, Trump made no mention of the grim milestone of 100,000 deaths. No written statement honoring those who have died. No condolences offered to families. Not even a tweet acknowledging the six-figure death toll. In Minnesota, parts of Minneapolis erupted in flames Wednesday night as residents took to the streets for a second night to protest the death of George Floyd, a black man killed by police on Monday. A video circulated widely on social media earlier this week showing George Floyd gasping for air, telling officers, "I can't breathe," while a white officer named Derek Chauvin pinned him to the pavement with a knee on his neck. Three other officers stood nearby. All four officers have since been fired. The officers confronted Floyd after receiving a complaint. He tried using a counterfeit bill to buy groceries. On Wednesday, protesters held a day-long demonstration outside the city's 3rd Precinct Police Headquarters. Police fired tear gas, flashbang grenades and projectiles in an attempt to disperse the crowd. Demonstrators also rallied outside the home of former officer Derek Chauvin. On Wednesday night, the city requested help from the National Guard as a number of buildings were set ablaze. Meanwhile, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey has called on prosecutors to file criminal charges against Chauvin.
Why is the man who killed George Floyd not in jail? George Floyd deserves justice. His family deserves justice. The black community deserves justice. And our city deserves justice.
The Star Tribune reports Derek Chauvin was involved in multiple police shootings in his 19 years on the Minneapolis police force and was the subject of a dozen police conduct complaints. Protests over the killing of George Floyd have also erupted in other cities, including Los Angeles, where demonstrators temporarily blocked traffic on Highway 101. We'll go to Minneapolis after headlines. China's parliament has approved a new law that criminalizes any conduct in Hong Kong that harms national security and allows Chinese intelligence agencies to set up in the former British colony for the first time. Hundreds of Hong Kong protesters have been arrested in recent days opposing the law, as well as a separate bill making disrespect of the Chinese national anthem a crime. Earlier today, a group of Hong Kong protesters gathered at a shopping mall.
Eventually, after they pass the national security law, if there is really a national security agency established in Hong Kong, then what will happen to the protesters? Does our next generation in Hong Kong need to be accepted into re-education camps like those in Xinjiang?
The Trump administration strongly criticized the new Chinese law. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has told Congress the U.S. no longer views Hong Kong as fully autonomous from China, a move that may lead to Hong Kong losing its special economic status with the United States. In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives held its first-ever remote vote on Wednesday, with over 70 Democratic lawmakers casting floor votes by proxy as they stayed away from Capitol Hill in order to stop community spread of the coronavirus. House Republicans Tuesday filed a federal lawsuit seeking to block remote voting as unconstitutional, describing it as a partisan power grab by majority Democrats. Meanwhile, civil liberties groups are calling on Congress members to vote down a Patriot Act reauthorization bill that would allow the Justice Department and FBI to spy on the internet browser histories of U.S. residents. A similar bill passed the Senate last week by a single vote. In New York, scores of activists held a car caravan protest outside the notorious Sing Sing prison Wednesday, demanding Governor Andrew Cuomo immediately release prisoners at risk of COVID-19. At least four Sing Sing prisoners have died of the disease. Dozens more have tested positive. Elsewhere, protesters deposited effigies of body bags outside New York City Hall Wednesday to mourn the deaths of 78 unhoused New Yorkers during the pandemic. The protesters held signs reading, "Mayor de Blasio, there is blood on your hands." They're demanding the city open thousands of vacant hotel rooms to unhouse people to isolate and for an end to punitive sweeps against the homeless. A new study finds even mild cases of COVID-19 trigger people's immune systems to produce antibodies against the novel coronavirus. The findings by researchers at the Pasteur Institute in France raise hopes that most people who contract the coronavirus will have some form of immunity against a second infection. Meanwhile, researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara say 6 feet of social distance might not be enough to stop the spread of the coronavirus, especially in cold and humid weather. The researchers found that under certain conditions, droplets carrying the virus can travel up to 20 feet after they're exhaled by infected people. The finding was published on a preprint server and has not yet been peer-reviewed. In southwestern Florida, there's been an explosion of coronavirus cases in Immokalee, with over 420 people testing positive. The rural community is home to some of Florida's largest populations of immigrant farm workers who've been deemed essential during the pandemic, but who often lack access to health care, paid sick leave, and other on-the-job protections. The aid group Doctors Without Borders is calling on Florida officials to aggressively ramp up testing and contact tracing for farm workers. In Brazil, police raided dozens of locations Wednesday linked to extremist right-wing activists propagating fake news online in support of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro. The raids came as part of an ongoing investigation into a fake news network that authorities believe is linked to the president's son, Carlos Bolsonaro. The raid came as Brazil's COVID-19 cases topped 410,000 with over 25,000 deaths. Brazil is now second to the United States for the most coronavirus infections in the world. In Argentina, security forces have sealed off one of the poorest neighborhoods in the outskirts of the capital, Buenos Aires, preventing people from entering or leaving after more than half of the slum's 300 residents tested positive for COVID-19 earlier the week. Local activists and some members of Argentina's leftist government condemned the move, saying it felt like the country was building ghettos for poor people. Argentina's slums are often overcrowded and lack proper sewerage or running water, making it nearly impossible for residents to isolate or maintain proper hygiene. In Peru, hospitals across the country are on the brink of collapse as coronavirus cases continue to surge, forcing some healthcare facilities to place patients in improvised tents outside.
Right now, we find ourselves in a collapsed reality. We don't have beds in the ICU. We don't have beds here in the Rosola Hospital. Patients are dying every day, and there are no results from authorities. So we're urgently asking for help for our personal protective equipment to arrive.
In Brussels, Belgium, the European Commission has unveiled a coronavirus aid package worth over $820 billion. The plan, which needs the unanimous support of all 27 European member nations, would speed investments in green industries like renewable energy as part of Europe's Green Deal initiative. Spain's begun 10 days of national mourning for victims of the coronavirus pandemic. So far, more than 27,000 people have died of COVID-19 in Spain. An international coalition of anti-war and human rights groups are calling on the U.S. Congress to block two pending weapon sales to the Philippines worth $2 billion, saying President Rodrigo Duterte has a legacy of human rights violations and that the weapons could be used to unleash violence on innocent Filipinos. In a letter to U.S. lawmakers, the coalition writes, quote, "What could help the Filipinos right now is aid for their under-resourced healthcare system and for programs to assist poor people to survive during the current lockdown, not an arms sale." This comes as Duterte has put the military in charge of the country's COVID-19 response. In early April, Duterte ordered troops to shoot dead anyone violating quarantine. And the legendary AIDS activist and playwright Larry Kramer has died at the age of 84. In 1983, he helped found the Gay Men's Health Crisis, the country's first AIDS organization. 4 years later, he helped form ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. The direct action group invaded the offices of drug companies and scientific labs, stormed St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, covered the home of Senator Jesse Helms in a giant condom, and conducted many die-ins at the FDA, all in an attempt to force the country to address the AIDS epidemic. Larry Kramer also wrote many plays, including The Normal Heart. Last year, he addressed the Queer Liberation March in New York City.
Everyone gay I've known has been affected by this plague of AIDS. As it has since its beginning, this has continued to be my motivation for everything I've done. It's been a fight I've been proud of fighting.
We'll look at Larry Kramer's legacy later in the broadcast with the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tony Kushner, journalist Ann Northrup, and Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Minneapolis, where parts of the city erupted into flames Wednesday night as residents again took to the streets to protest the death of George Floyd, a black man killed by white police officer Derek Chauvin Monday. A viral video shows Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for a number of minutes as Floyd repeatedly says, "I cannot breathe." Three other officers stood by as George Floyd suffocated. They've been identified as Tu Thao, Thomas Lane, and J. Alexander Kung. All four officers were fired Tuesday. On Wednesday night, the city requested help from the National Guard as a number of buildings were set ablaze. The protest followed a day-long demonstration outside the city's 3rd Precinct Police Headquarters, where police fired tear gas and projectiles at the protesters. Demonstrators also rallied outside the home of former officer Derek Chauvin. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called on prosecutors to file criminal charges against Derek Chauvin Wednesday.
With more than anything else over the last 36 hours, one fundamental question. Why is the man who killed George Floyd not in jail? If you had done it, or I had done it, we would be behind bars right now. And I cannot come up with a good answer to that question. And so I'm calling on Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman to act on the evidence before him. I'm calling on him to charge the arresting officer in this case. We cannot turn a blind eye. It is on us as leaders to see this for what it is and call it what it is. George Floyd deserves justice. His family deserves justice. The black community deserves justice. And our city deserves justice.
The Star Tribune reports Derek Chauvin has been involved in multiple police shootings in his 19 years on the Minneapolis police force and was the subject of a dozen police conduct complaints. In 2008, he shot and injured a man while making a domestic assault call. In 2006, he was one of six officers who killed a man after responding to a stabbing. NBC News reports it's unclear from the police report which officers fired their weapons. The other police officer identified in the video of George Floyd's murder is Tutau. He was sued for use of excessive force in 2017. According to the lawsuit, by Lamar Ferguson was walking home with a woman who was 8 months pregnant when Tao and another officer stopped them and searched them without cause. The officers handcuffed Ferguson and Tao threw him to the ground and punched him repeatedly, according to the lawsuit. The case settled for $25,000. This is Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, the former congressman, speaking on Wednesday. He announced both state and federal officials have opened investigations into the killing of George Floyd.
This investigation must proceed with a degree of objectivity. We're not going to prejudge the facts, though the video is so clear before our eyes. Why? Because at the end of this process, we want nobody to be able to question the process. So what we're dealing with is not an isolated case. We're dealing with a systemic problem. And the investigation and the prosecution, if that happens, and the ultimate consequences, they are being handled. I'm confident that they're being handled competently. But that doesn't end it. The discharge of the officers doesn't end it. The criminal process that has begun doesn't end it. The civil rights process doesn't end it. We've got to have permanent, deep, systemic change.
Minnesota's African-American Attorney General Keith Ellison also was the first Muslim elected to Congress. We go now to Minneapolis, where we're joined by Nakima Levy Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Your city is in flames. Can you talk about what's happened this week and what you're demanding?
Yes. So we know that George Floyd was unjustly killed by Minneapolis police officers. The video has gone viral. People are outraged. This is yet another reminder that the Minneapolis Police Department has a culture of violence, specifically when it comes to their interactions with the African-American community. And so as a result of what happened to George Floyd, we took to the streets in a 2.5 mile march from the site of where he was killed to the 3rd Precinct Police Station, where thousands of people stood in solidarity, standing up for justice for George Floyd. And in the last couple of days, there have been skirmishes between law enforcement officials and protesters. I just actually left the site a little while ago, and some of the buildings were burning that were in close proximity to the 3rd Precinct Police Station. And although some people are surprised by this, I'm not surprised, because we've been warning city officials for many years that Minneapolis was going to become the next Ferguson if they did not clean up the Minneapolis Police Department and address the other racial inequities that we experience as African Americans.
So can you respond to the family calling for the police officers to be brought up on murder charges, not just Chauvin, who is the one who kneeled on the neck of George Floyd as he pleaded for his life, saying, I cannot breathe. The mayor calling for criminal charges, the attorney general, what he is calling for in Minnesota, and also President Trump saying he's looking at the case.
Well, the reality is that it wasn't just Chauvin who was responsible for the death of George Floyd. There were actually three officers that were pressing upon his body, that were holding him down so that he could not move. And there was a fourth officer who was standing guard, preventing community members from intervening in that situation. I mean, the community members did the best that they could to ask the officers to please allow Mr. George Floyd to be able to get up. And their cries and George Floyd's cries fell on deaf ears. Just the flagrant attitudes of the officers and the nonchalant way that they responded to a man just simply asking to be able to breathe is absolutely unconscionable. And I agree with the family. I agree with the community that those officers should be immediately charged for the murder of George Floyd. They should have already been arrested by now. It just is. It's a no-brainer. Any of us who had engaged in that level of conduct would already be in jail. Just because they're officers does not mean that they should get away with this type of behavior. Firing them is a first step, but it is not enough on the road towards justice for people to feel satisfied by that outcome.
Let's go to the Minneapolis police chief, Arredondo, speaking Wednesday.
I certainly have said publicly as well that what I observed, those actions from those former four officers, in no way reflect the values and the vision and the culture that I want to change here with the Minneapolis Police Department, and that so many of our men and women work each and every day to try to build those relationships of trust.
Arredondo was speaking with a mask on. We did not see the police officers who were involved with the killing of George Floyd with a mask. But you, what are you demanding of Police Chief Arredondo?
Well, we are demanding that the body camera footage be released. As I mentioned earlier, of course, we want the officers charged immediately, although that decision is not in the hands of Chief Arredondo. We had requested that those officers be fired, and he agreed that they needed to be fired. And that was an unprecedented move to have officers who are white officers be fired for killing a black person. That has not happened. Normally, officers are allowed to remain on the force after they have killed someone. So in addition to the charges and the body camera footage, we want to see systemic changes within the Minneapolis Police Department. We want to see a cultural shift. We're also asking for the appointment of a special prosecutor. We simply do not trust the Hennepin County Attorney, Mike Freeman, to make a fair and objective decision, because typically he sides with law enforcement officers. He has not held a single officer accountable for shooting a civilian, for killing a civilian, except in the case of Justine Damon, who was a white affluent woman who was shot and killed by a black Muslim Somali man. And we saw after a period of time where Mike Freeman actually did bring charges, and ultimately Muhammad Noor was convicted and he is spending time in prison. Most of the officers who kill people in Minneapolis and in the state of Minnesota are white men, but not one has been charged and convicted for killing a black person in the state of Minnesota. And we believe that that needs to change. It needs to change now. And they need to be held accountable for George Floyd's murder.
I wanted to turn to the eyewitness, one of the eyewitnesses. We see people from the cell phone footage who are filming. He was right there. He went on CNN's Chris Cuomo show last night and described what he saw.
Part that makes the least sense, did any of the cops, did you hear them talking to each other about why they couldn't just move him and get him out of the situation?
bro, they wanted to kill that man, bro. Like, I'm gonna be 100, bro. They didn't speak. They didn't say nothing. The views in his eyes, bro. The man that had his knee on his chest, bro. He knew what he was doing. His shimmies in my man's neck, bro. He knew what he was doing. It's just like having a jiu-jitsu choke. If I'm here, I'm shivving, I'm shimmy, I'm shimmy, I'm shimmy, boom, my choke's on there. I told him it was a blood choke. He knew it was a blood choke. He looked at me when I said it. He put his head down. He did not make any more gestures. He did not say any other thing. And the two other cowards that was on the other side of the car, I didn't know nothing about. I didn't know about it until I got videos in my social media and things like that. So they was intent to smother my man and kill my man. And I seen it. I seen it in his eyes. I seen it in his demeanor. And I seen it in their movement. And Officer Tao didn't partake in it. But he had control of what was going on the other side of that car for me not to see what was going on. Because the people that know me personally know how I am. And I'm a controlled athlete. I'm a controlled person. You know, I have different levels to who I am. And I show my controlledness out there in front of the world. I got letters, notes from multiple people that know me from growing up in the city that said I was the most controlled they ever seen in my life. As I'm seeing another man that looked like me, that feels like me, that got the same complexion as me, lose his life to another man that had no senseless. He had no feeling. He had no remorse. He had in him. He had no feeling. I don't even think he had a heart at that moment. And he's going to feel that for the rest of his life. Just like I'm going to hear my man say this. I can't breathe. I want my mama. And I'm coming to find out that this man died 2 years and the day that his mom died. I'm a mama's boy, bro. Like, that hurts me deep down inside, bro. And like, something needs to be done, or something needs to be done.
That was eyewitness Donald Williams describing the killing of George Floyd. Nikema Levy-Armstrong, as you hear this, and the family is demanding murder charges be brought against all four officers. Right now, parts of Minneapolis, southern Minneapolis, are in flames. Your final thoughts on what needs to happen at this point?
What needs to happen is that charges need to be brought immediately against the four officers who killed George Floyd. There is simply no justification for what they did or why they did it. And people have to wake up and understand that as Black people, we do not feel safe in the city of Minneapolis. We do not feel safe in the state of Minnesota. We do not feel safe around this country when it comes to our interactions with law enforcement. And like he said, that needs to change, and it needs to change now.
Okay. And the other video footage that we have seen and that we haven't seen, one from Dragon Walk across the street, in the store footage, the police officers claim that he was resisting arrest, but we see him coming out of the car. We see the police officers holding him. They handcuff him. They walk him across the street. And that's when they take him down. Can you explain this?
There is no explanation. And I think that people need to shift their focus on from whether he was resisting arrest or not. That has nothing to do with the fact that they compressed that man's body, put the full weight of a human body on his neck, and snuffed the life out of him.
For something like 8 minutes.
Absolutely. Who can justify that? That was a modern day lynching. No other words for that. That was a modern day lynching. So people have to realize what they witnessed, be honest about it, and push for accountability and not allow them to use technicalities as a way to justify what happened to George Floyd. It doesn't matter about his past. It doesn't matter whether he was resisting or he didn't. It doesn't matter what happened in the store. What matters is that those officers had a chance to ensure that George Floyd could live and not die, that he could breathe and not suffocate or have whatever kind of response to his body that happened. He should be alive today to tell his story. They took that away from him, and they should be held accountable.
This is Floyd's brother, Filonis, speaking on CNN Tuesday.
I love my brother. Everybody loved my brother. Knowing my brother is to love my brother. They could have tased him. They could have maced him. Instead, they put their knee in his neck and just sat on him and didn't care at all. He screamed, "Mama, mama, I can't breathe. I can't breathe." And they just didn't care. So I just don't understand what more we got to go through in life, man. They didn't have to do that to him.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis, speaking on CNN on Tuesday. Benjamin Crump, now the family attorney, has already filed a lawsuit against Minneapolis. We will continue to follow this story. We want to thank Nakima Levy Armstrong, civil rights attorney, activist, founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP, for being with us. When we come back, we look at the life and legacy of Larry Kramer, the legendary writer, trailblazing activist in the fight against AIDS. He died on Thursday. Stay with us. The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed by composer Joel Thompson, performed by The Sphinx, led by conductor Eugene Rogers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour looking at the life and legacy of Larry Kramer, the legendary writer, the trailblazing activist in the fight against AIDS, who died from pneumonia Thursday in New York at the age of 84. Many credit Larry Kramer for saving thousands of lives affected by the disease. At least 32 million people have now died from HIV/AIDS in the world. Larry Kramer was an Oscar-nominated screenwriter for the 1969 film Women in Love by D.H. Lawrence. His semi-autobiographical play, The Normal Heart, chronicled the AIDS epidemic and helped bring the crisis to the public's attention. In 1983, he co-founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which became a leading provider of HIV/AIDS prevention and activism. 4 years later, he helped form ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. The Direct Action Group invaded the offices of drug companies and scientific labs, stormed St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, covered the home of Senator Jesse Helms in a giant condom, and conducted many die-ins at the FDA, all in an attempt to force the country to address the AIDS epidemic. Kramer famously fought with Dr. Anthony Fauci, now the leading member of President Trump's coronavirus task force, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. In an open letter to the San Francisco Examiner in 1988, Kramer accused Fauci of failing to respond quickly to the AIDS epidemic and called him a murderer. The two later became friends. Fauci credited Kramer and ACT UP for speeding up the drug testing process. In a New Yorker magazine profile of Kramer this month, Michael Spector interviewed Fauci, who told him, quote, "In American medicine, there are two eras, before Larry and after Larry." Spector wrote, quote, "There is no question in my mind that Larry helped change medicine in this country." In a moment, we'll host a roundtable on Larry Kramer's legacy. But first, this is Larry Kramer in his own words. Last year, 4 million people took to the streets of New York City in the largest LGBTQ pride celebration in history to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising. There were two marches that day. Revelers marched down Fifth Avenue, cheered on by millions for the World Pride Parade. And in Sheridan Square, at the site where gay and trans people clashed with police in 1969, tens of thousands gathered for the anti-corporate Queer Liberation March. Democracy Now! Was there. When we went up to Central Park, people went on the podium. Larry Krasner sat in his wheelchair, and Larry Kramer sat in his wheelchair and addressed the crowd.
What does pride mean to you? I'll tell you what it means to me. I love being gay. I love my people. I think in many ways we're better than other people. I think we're smarter and more talented and more aware of each other. And I totally do. I am very proud to be gay. I'm approaching my end, but I still have a few years of fight left in me to scream out. To scream out the fact that almost everyone gay I've known has been affected by this plague of AIDS. As it has since its beginning, this has continued to be my motivation for everything I've done. It's been a fight I've been proud of fighting. I almost died 3 times. I started a couple of organizations to fight with me against the plague. In the end, we failed. I certainly feel that I failed. There is no cure for this plague. Too many of us are still getting infected. We have become too complacent with PrEP. Research for the cure is still in the Stone Age. The few treatments we have are woefully expensive and come with troublesome side effects, and their manufacturer is holding us up to ransom. Yes, we have lost the fight against AIDS. It is hard to stand up to the huge portion of the population of American people that hates us. I don't mean dislike. I mean hate. When we started dying, we told the American people what was happening to us, but the American people didn't do anything. I hope it's finally dawning on you that maybe those American people didn't and don't want to do anything about this. I hope you might have noticed, I can't tell, laws and regulations that sort of protected us are now being repealed or rewritten. Their media, their newspapers, their networks of the rich and religious, their very president and vice president will see to it that we are useless, their wildest dreams are coming true. The faggots are disappearing, and they are doing it to themselves. We have everything required to save our world, except the will to do it. It should have been simple. Fight for our rights, take care of ourselves and each other, be proud of ourselves, be proud we are gay. This should be what every gay person is fighting for 7 days each and every week.
Larry Kramer, speaking just under a year ago at the Queer Liberation March in New York City in Central Park. When we come back, we host a roundtable discussion on his life and legacy with two ACT UP members, epidemiologist Greg Gonsalves and Gay USA co-host Ann Northrup, as well as Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Tony Kushner. Stay with us. The Man I Love, performed by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we spend the rest of the hour looking at the life and legacy of Larry Kramer, the legendary writer, the trailblazing activist in the fight against AIDS, who died from pneumonia Thursday in New York. He died on Wednesday in New York at the age of 84. Many credit Larry Kramer for saving thousands of lives affected by the disease. At least 32 million people have died from HIV/AIDS in the world. Joining us from their various homes, Ann Northrup, co-host of Gay USA, veteran journalist, used to be at CBS, activist who worked with Reclaim Pride Coalition to produce last year's Queer Liberation March, where Larry Kramer spoke from his wheelchair. She worked with Kramer as a member of ACT UP, was arrested some 24 times for civil disobedience. Also here in New York, Greg Gonsalves, assistant professor of epidemiology of microbial diseases at Yale School of Public Health, co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership. He, too, worked with Larry Kramer and activists in ACT UP. And in a minute, we'll be joined by the renowned playwright and screenwriter, Tony Kushner. Ann Northrup, your response to Larry's death and the significance of his life. I wanted to talk about the New York Times obit that was changed yesterday. The subtitle was changed. They originally wrote, Larry Kramer, author and outspoken AIDS activist, dies at 84. He worked hard to shock the country into dealing with AIDS as a public health emergency, but his often abusive approach could overshadow his achievements. They changed the word abusive to aggressive, to confrontational. Your thoughts?
Well, Larry's a complicated subject. You could use many words to describe him. I love Larry, and I love hearing that excerpt from his speech last year. Thank you for that. And it sort of encapsulated everything about Larry, his loving of gay people and all people, his anger at people in power and the government that was allowing people to die, He was a very mixed bag, and I loved him certainly, and loved him for his anger. But there were also a lot of people who thought he went too far or was too negative, as he ended up at the end of that speech. It's hard to encapsulate it all in a couple of sentences.
But talk about the creative approach. I mean, he started Gay Men's Health Crisis, but then was not satisfied with it, saying that it was not political enough. It was a service organization. And so then helped to start ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And if you can talk about the various approaches and protests, talk about creativity, from invading the CBS Evening News studios when Dan Rather was introducing the evening news and saying, kill AIDS, not gays, to putting a condom around Senator Jesse Helms' house.
Well, provocative was certainly the word that described ACT UP and still does. And that was to get attention. As Larry said, people in power were perfectly happy to let other people die. And that's a theme we've seen throughout history. We've seen it in the Vietnam War. We've seen it in the civil rights movement. We've seen it in Minneapolis with George Floyd. Power wants to replicate itself, not actually take care of other people. So Larry's attitude, and one he transferred to all of us, was that you have to get in their faces. You have to scream and yell. You have to get their attention, people in power, and you have to create as much of a mass protest to attack that attitude from power to have any effect. You have to force people into paying attention. You have to shame them publicly. Tony Fauci was quoted as saying, after he became friendly with Larry, that they would have dinner one night and then Larry would go out the next morning and start screaming about Tony being a murderer. And that Tony understood that because he understood the process. But I think many of us were frustrated at his calm attitude, Fauci's attitude, because we wanted that anger. We wanted that for action. We wanted urgency. People were dying. And that's what Larry personified in his anger.
From one plague to another, Greg Gonsalves, you're an epidemiologist, you're an ACT UP activist, well known. I wanted you to respond to what Anthony Fauci said about Larry Kramer. He said, in American medicine, there are two eras, before Larry and after Larry.
So I think, to be fair to history, we have to give other people their due. I know we're memorializing Larry this morning, but ACT UP was a large movement with many, many people working on AIDS research and drug development. And there were other groups like Project Inform in San Francisco, led by Marty Delaney and Jesse Dobson and Brenda Lean and others doing work across the country in San Francisco. I think there is biomedical research and drug development pre-AIDS and post-AIDS. I think after the 1980s and 1990s, biomedical research will never be the same. I was on a call yesterday with breast cancer survivors at their annual meeting, and you realized it wasn't just for AIDS that the ACT UP and our movement was important. It was for people fighting for their own health and their own lives across diseases, from breast cancer to ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, to TB and hepatitis C. The movement is so much more robust and broad now than we ever thought it could be back in the 1980s and 1990s. And Larry was one of the sparks that lit the fire. But there are so many people whose memories we can't lose, even as we memorialize him today.
And those deaths, Larry Kramer repeatedly drummed in the number of people who had died. On Wednesday, the gay rights activist Peter Staley tweeted an image of an article in the New York Times writing, quote, on January 25th, 1991, this is how the New York Times reported that 100,000 Americans had died from AIDS. They didn't bother writing their own story. They ran an Associated Press story instead. On page 18, below the fold, no pictures, no names. Greg Gonsalves, you are an epidemiologist now. You're dealing with this plague, coronavirus, which Larry was writing about at the end of his life. The comparison of the plague of AIDS and the plague of COVID-19.
Well, we have two presidents who botched the response to two different epidemics. Larry said, I think on the CBS piece in the 80s, that we died from AIDS because we were disposable people. We didn't matter. Well, there's a new era and new epidemic and a new set of disposable people, whether they're dying in nursing homes or they're dying in communities of color in meatpacking plants and prisons. For those of us who are in ACT UP, we recognize what's going on now, and it's been beyond benign neglect. It's malevolence. It's premeditated murder. And Larry knew very well what was happening then, and he knew what was happening now in the epidemic that we're facing today.
I wanted to bring Tony Kushner into this discussion, the renowned playwright and screenwriter, won a Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award for his play Angels in America, which was later made into an award-winning television miniseries. His other plays include Homebody Cobble, Caroline or Change, and A Bright Room Called Day. His most recent play, The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Capitalism and Socialism with a Key to the Scriptures. Tony Kushner was a friend of Larry Kramer's. Tony, I was wondering if you could start off by talking about Larry Kramer's trip to the White House under Reagan, who did not mention the word AIDS for something like 6.5 years of his two terms, as the plague raged through the community in this country, not to mention around the world. He went there with Liz Taylor. Talk about what happened.
Well, this is something that was reported at the time and then was memorialized, sort of immortalized in Randy Schilt's book And the Band Played On. Larry asked Elizabeth Taylor to bring him to the White House to a sort of a dinner. I don't remember right now what the purpose of the dinner ostensibly was, but it was at a moment when Reagan was, sort of riding the crest of his popularity. He'd been reelected. And when he got up to speak, the president of the United States, Larry stood up and started to boo him loudly, which was an astonishing moment. It was an appropriate thing because Reagan, of course, notoriously never mentioned the epidemic until 1987. He sat as president, making no public utterance while thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans got sick and died. Larry standing up and booing him, it's what Ann was saying earlier. There was a politics that Larry certainly helped to invent of a kind of an in-your-face refusal to behave according to any codes that were, ostensibly about being civilized and polite and orderly in the name of getting people to hear the truth. And that was one of the signal moments. It certainly had an enormous impact on me when I read about it before I knew Larry. So
if you can talk about how you got to know him and the significance of who he was, from being a playwright like yourself to being this uncompromising activist.
Yeah, I mean, I think for people, for gay men of my generation, the first awareness that most of us had of Larry was when his really extraordinary novel, Faggots, was published. And I mean, just the title alone was incendiary. It was a shock to the heterosexual population, and it was a shock to the LGBT community. It was a word that many of us felt we were fighting to permanently retire. He embraced it. You heard in that astonishing speech that you played earlier, Amy, that he was still using it. It was an early manifestation of the sexual minoritarian people calling themselves queer. And then the normal heart happened after that in 1985, I believe, 86, at the Public Theater in New York. And it was a play like none other before. I think it's one of the rare works of art that actually is both a great work of art and galvanized people to immediate action. It's a rare work of art that was written about an overwhelmingly terrible moment in the moment that it's describing. I still don't understand how Larry did that. And for people who are interested in theater, for people who are interested in politics, Normal Heart gave, I think, a permission for gay theater to become overtly political. And it, you know, it was sort of part of Larry's whole project, which in a certain sense, I mean, I agree with Anne. He's an impossible person to sum up briefly, and in many ways he was an impossible person, but he was a very great man and a great writer. And one of the things that he kept screaming at his community was that we had to take ourselves really seriously. And that argument with us, with himself, started in the earliest openly gay writings that he penned, and it continued to the end of his life. He was a very tough person. He and I were very close friends for a while, and then we had a falling out, and then a reconciliation of sorts. But I admired him enormously, and revere his memory.
He famously wrote in the early 80s one of the first articles warning about the AIDS epidemic called 1,112 and Counting. At the time, there were just over 1,000 cases of AIDS. He wrote, "Unless we fight for our lives, we shall die. Every gay man who is unable to come forward now and fight to save his own life is truly helping to kill the rest of us." Comparing, Tony Kushner, these two viruses, comparing AIDS to what we're confronting today, something Larry was also dealing with in these last days.
Well, I mean, I think that what Greg said is pretty much a definition of it. I mean, it's a pandemic that in many ways is wildly different from what the AIDS epidemic was. It's far less ignorable by the general population that in its early days AIDS appeared to be. The population of people immediately affected by
AIDS. We just have
10
seconds because we want to end with the words of Larry.
Okay. So it's, I think all epidemics, all crises reveal certain fundamental truths about our society, its degree of coherence and its degree of incoherence, and how the vulnerable suffer more from that kind of incoherence. I think that's what Larry was about.
Let's go to the words of Larry Kramer from that clear queer liberation speech last year.
Do you think our enemies care about the rise of HIV infections? They're grateful for them. They thank us for our cooperation and our silence and our invisibility. And while all this happened, what did we do? We shrank from our duty of opposition. Yes, our duty of opposition. In other words, fight back! We need to fight back all together as one. I would love to hear you and see you express the importance of this if you love being gay as much as I do. Fight back.
Larry Kramer, dead at the age of 84, will post the whole speech online. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.